From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Wereman by Les Daniels. He had no name. Few wolves do, and little enough of memory. And when he remembered anything at all, it was not the cold, sharp air of the forest piercing his nostrils, nor the musky scent of frightened prey, for there is no need to recall what is so often there. Instead, his recollections were of stranger scents, flaming bits of bodies with the blood burnt out of them, and beings trapped in rolling iron boxes, each one spewing forth cloud upon cloud of deadly fumes instead of sweet, pungent droppings. These odors haunted him, along with visions of pale, hairless things that staggered on their fat hind legs, their paws wrapped in dried skin stolen from other creatures. Such things were monstrous, as were the celebrations in airless wooden boxes that did not move, where there was nothing to breathe but smoking weeds and the stink of fermented fruits and grains. There might be howling in such a box, but it came from another box, and it was marred by the sound of lightning forced through scraping metal wire and wind forced through dried dead reeds. He dreamed of these things when the moon was round, and had he been able to, he might have spoken of them to his fellows in the pack. Yet he was grateful that he had no words and wondered why he knew of them at all. They were one of his dreams. He slept in a den with his mate and her pups. He cuddled with her when she gave him the scent, yet still he dreamed of nuzzling loins that reeked of mint or even strawberry. Horror possessed him. He trembled and howled, and all the more because his tiny forebrain knew as much of the truth as it could contain. When the light in the sky became a circle, he became a man. He whimpered and snuggled into the musty fur of his mate, wondering all the while if it was her beauty or his own bestiality that was only a fragment of his troubled sleep. He wondered where he was. Then he was free, loping through the snow in the deep track that had been plowed for him by a wandering moose, hearing nothing but the whisper of the wind and the touch of his feet on the ice beneath them. Hunger bit at his belly, almost like another animal attacking him. Perhaps that was what had started the dreams, and then driven him out into the night. His pack was starving, all of them, and they could not range free from the den while the pups were new. They would not survive much longer without food, and so he hunted on and on for more than a dozen miles, pausing only to mark the trail with his leg lifted. It was when he lowered his leg that he realized the change was coming, for the pads on his foot turned suddenly tender, and the cold cut through them. He had lost the talent, which all wolves possess, of regulating his own body temperature, and by this sign he could tell that he was turning into a monster. He began to shiver in the frigid air, rearing up on his hind legs to snap at nothing, a growl in his throat as he felt his teeth drawn painfully back into his head until he had only 32 little stumps, hardly enough to feel the muzzle being crushed back into his face. Everything was pulling back into him, and everything was agony. He experienced each individual hair as it was absorbed into his stinging flesh, and then he bloated, bulking up into a pink and swollen thing more than twice his proper weight, a thick and weak and hairless thing that feared the gentle dark. It fled, shaking and screaming through the snow, and it took him with it. With feeble, bleeding, clawless forepaws, the man he had become turned over a rock made slippery with a transparent glaze and found the cache of clothes beneath it. He could not remember how they came to be there, but when he crawled into them from the cold, it could not hurt him as much. Everything about him had changed except his hunger. He staggered on in search of food, his numb feet stuffed into the skin of slaughtered cows. Much of the night had given way to his slow progress through the snow, Before he topped a rise and let his eyes confirm the truth his ears and nose had told him long ago, he was about to enter the other world. Below him was an endless stream of poison gas floating over a strip of ground that looked like a dry riverbed, and through that raced a succession of the iron boxes with humans caught inside. These beings seemed to be following the moon the way he was. In fact, each one of their boxes was in pursuit of two bright yellow disks of light that it could never catch. He saw that much almost at once, but decided he would follow the lights too. This was what men did. Perhaps there was food at the mouth of the empty river. Dragging his feet through the piles of the gray slush that spattered at him, he paced through the headlights. He began to know their names, staying carefully to one side as it came back to him that cars could kill. Finally, he realized where they were going. It was not the moon they were pursuing after all, but a big red star whose outline glowed against the sky. There were red squiggles beside it, and somehow he knew that they meant Red Star too, although that made no sense when the red star was right there beside them anyway. And they didn't look like what they said. They looked like splashes of blood on black snow. Then he saw the red star was another box, but so much bigger than the others, but he could not look around it. Most of it seemed to be made of ice. It glistened in vast sheets, and light came shining through to fall on him. The cars opened, and those who had been caught inside rushed away like sensible creatures, but then gravitated at once toward the giant trap that looked like fire enclosed in ice. He sensed their hunger, and despite his fear, he followed them. A good hunter could steal food even from a snare. He was startled by the glare inside, brighter than sunlight and colder than moonlight. He closed his eyes against it as death filled his nostrils. Hundreds of animals had perished here, and their bodies had not been consumed. The overwhelming sense of slaughter and of waste filled him with dread even as he felt himself begin to drool. Someone shoved against him. He snarled and raised his upper lip before he remembered that he had no fangs to bear. Dozens of humans had gathered here, but they were not a pack. Each one was like a lone wolf without a territory of its own. Each one was angry and aggressive and afraid. They had hold of other little boxes that moved like the cars did, and they pushed them at each other as they passed. Some of them put things in these small boxes, and just the sight of that made his head swim. Everything in this world was inside something else. Nothing ran free. The noise he had dreamed about washed over him again. Wires and reeds and skins struck by sticks, with a scraping of hair against gut wailing over them. He found himself humming along with it against his will. He was becoming more like the humans with every minute he spent among them. He took a shopping cart and did with it what the others were doing. The light was so intense it almost blinded him, just as darkness would blind a man, and the music made him deaf. Only the stubbing pink nose he had been cursed with told him anything at all. It spoke of meat. He was in an aisle filled with meat. The floors were meat, and the walls were meat, and they stretched out before him as far as his dazzled eyes could see. The sight should have brought him joy, but there was terror in it too, the terror that only excess can bring. Had there ever been a time when so many animals had died at once? What could have killed them all, and what had stopped it from eating them? The front of his back would have stood on end if it had not vanished hours ago. He could smell cattle and sheep and pigs, chickens and turkeys and ducks, a few kinds of fish he recognized, and many more he did not. He could smell hundreds of dead creatures, thousands of them, and on each of them was the stench of decay. This was not fresh meat. Still quivering with a hot pulse of blood, this was something sliced and drained and spoiled. It was cold, too. He felt the chill of death seep into his hand as he clutched involuntarily at part of a cow. The meat had already been chewed up, like what he regurgitated to feed his cubs, and it was enclosed in transparent ice, like the stuff that made up the walls of the big star. With trembling fingers, he dropped it into his cart. Nearby lay pigs which had been masticated and then stuffed into their own intestines, even though such parts of an animal were not good to eat. He passed them by, but he could not resist the chance to sweep three chickens into the cart, even though they were as cold and hard as stone. Then he was on a rampage. grabbing with numb fingers at the ribs of a hog, the leg of a lamb, the brain of a calf. He snatched at a cluster of chicken livers, still swimming in chilled blood, and felt the sticky liquid squirt out over his hand. He licked it and saw a female staring at him. He growled at her. It was time to go, time to escape with this meat before he joined it in those frigid walls that surrounded him. Panic surged through him when he saw that the way out was blocked, and then he recognized the checkout line for what it was. This standing in a row was something only humans did, and he was delighted by his cleverness in understanding it. Perhaps he would get away after all. He followed a metal cage that had been loaded with the icy fragments of dead animals. Humans stood before him, and behind him, similarly laden, their wire traps having captured creatures that were already corpses. But it was not this ugly image that made him shiver. Instead, he was possessed by the idea of taking these broken bodies to a place where he could expose them to a flame and watch the fat and juice flare into the sky, leaving him nothing but a dried husk to chew. The very thought made him gag, but he knew he would carry out this mad plan unless something stopped him. He tried to hold on to a picture of his pups, waiting in the burrow he had dug with his own paws, but somehow they seemed very far away, and he knew that they might die without seeing any of this meat he had hunted down for them. Squinting against the glare around him, he watched those ahead of him file out into the night. Some sort of ritual seemed to be involved. They had to pass before a young female, hardly more than a cub herself, and they had to let her touch each one of their treasures as they greeted her. And there was something else. Each one made an offering to her, passing her something that looked like a green leaf, and sometimes more than one. But where could they have found green leaves in the winter? At this time of the year, they were scarcer than prey. His twitching hands were empty, and the clothes he wore began to itch. He laid out his catch before the female and allowed her to touch it. 42.49, she said. He had no idea what these sounds meant. She looked at him. He suddenly felt dizzy. 42.49, she said. He thought of green leaves and of summer and of plentiful game. He dropped to his knees. The human behind him saw what was happening and sprinted for the dairy section at the back of the store. The cashier leaned over a register to get a better look just as he rose again on his hind legs. His slavering jaw closed on her face. He fed, and not on putrid, juiceless carrion. He experienced the taste of living blood splashing in his mouth, the feel of hot flesh throbbing against his tongue. The purity, the truth of it, his throat was full. He shrugged off the last of his clothing and ran. The big star opened up its glistening wall of ice and set him free. He danced around a stream of rolling traps and capered along the unbroken snow until he reached the shelter of the trees. The chunks of the young cashier were safe inside him, ready to be coughed up when he was home at last. His children would eat tonight. The Demon Lover by Elizabeth Bowen. Toward the end of the day in London, Mrs. Drover went around to her shut-up house to look for several things she wanted to take away. Some belonged to her, some to her family, who were by now used to their country life. It was late August. It had been a steamy, showery day. At the moment, the trees down the pavement glittered in an escape of humid yellow afternoon sun. Against the next batch of clouds, already piling up, ink dark, broken chimneys and parapets stood out. In her once familiar street, as in any unused channel, an unfamiliar queerness had stilted up. A cat wove itself in and out of railings, but no human eye watched Mrs. Drover's return. Shifting some parcels under her arm, she slowly forced around her latch key in an unwilling lock and gave the door, which had warped, a push with her knee. Dead air came out to meet her as she went in. The staircase window having been boarded up, no light came down into the hall, but one door she could just see stood ajar, so she went quickly through into the room and unshuttered the big window in there. Now the prosaic woman, looking about her, was more perplexed than she knew by everything she saw, by traces of her long former habit of life. The yellow smoke stain up the white marble mantelpiece, the ring left by a vase on the top of the escritoire, the bruise in the wallpaper where on the door being thrown open widely, the china handle had always hit the wall. The piano, having gone away to be stored, had left what looked like claw marks on its part of the parquet. Though not much dust had seeped in, each object wore film of another kind, and the only ventilation being the chimney, the whole drawing room smelled of the cold hearth. Mrs. Drover put down her parcels on the escritoire and left the room to proceed upstairs. The things she wanted were in a bedroom chest. She had been anxious to see how the house was. The part-time caretaker she shared with some neighbors was away this week on his holiday, known to be not yet back. At the best of times, he did not look in often, and she was never sure that she trusted him. There were some cracks in the structure left by the last bombing, on which he was anxious to keep an eye. Not that one could do anything. A shaft of refracted daylight now lay across the hall. She stopped dead and stared at the tall table. On this lay a letter addressed to her. She thought first, then the caretaker must be back. All the same, who, seeing the house was shuttered, would have dropped the letter in at the box? It was not a circular, it was not a bill, and the post office redirected to the address in the country, everything for her that came through the post. The caretaker, even if he was back, did not know she was due in London today. Her call here had been planned to be a surprise, so his negligence in the manner of this letter, leaving it to wait in the dusk and the dust, annoyed her. Annoyed, she picked up the letter, which bore no stamp, but it cannot be important, or they would know. She took the letter rapidly upstairs with her, without a stop to look at the writing till she reached what had been her bedroom, where she let in light. The room looked over the garden and other gardens. The sun had gone in as the clouds sharpened and lowered. The trees and rank lawns seemed already to smoke with dark. Her reluctance to look again at the letter came from the fact that she felt intruded upon, and by someone contemptuous of her ways. However, in the tenseness preceding the fall of rain, she read it. It was a few lines. "Dear Kathleen, you will not have forgotten that today is our anniversary, and the day we said. The years have gone by, at once slowly and fast. In view of the fact that nothing has changed, I shall rely upon you to keep your promise. I was sorry to see you leave London, but was satisfied that you would be back in time. You may expect me, therefore, at the hour arranged. Until then, K." Mrs. Drover looked for the date. It was today's. She dropped the letter onto the bedsprings, then picked it up to see the writing again. Her lips, beneath the remains of lipstick, beginning to go white. She felt so much the change in her own face that she went to the mirror, polishing a clear patch in it, and looked at once urgently and stealthily. She was confronted by a woman of 44, with the eyes starting out under a hat brim that had been rather carelessly pulled down. She had not put on any more powder since she left the shop where she ate her solitary tea. The pearls her husband had given her on their marriage hung loose around her now rather thinner throat, slipping into the V of the pink wool jumper her sister knitted last autumn as they sat around the fire. Mrs. Drover's most normal expression was one of controlled worry, but of assent. Since the birth of the third of her little boys, attended by a quite serious illness, she had an intermittent muscular flicker to the left of her mouth. But in spite of this, she could always sustain a manner that was at once energetic and calm. Turning from her own face as precipitously as she had gone to meet it, she went to the chest where the things were, unlocked it, threw up the lid, and knelt to search. But as rain began to come crashing down, she could not keep from looking over her shoulder at the stripped bed on which the letter lay. Behind the blanket of rain, the clock of the church that still stood struck six. With rapidly heightening apprehension, she counted each of the slow strokes. The hour arranged. "My God," she said. "What hour? How should I? After 25 years? The young girl, talking to the soldier in the garden, had not ever completely seen his face. It was dark. They were saying goodbye under a tree. Now and then, for it felt from not seeing him at this intense moment as though she had never seen him at all, She verified his presence for these few moments longer by putting out a hand, which in each time pressed, without very much kindness, and painfully onto one of the breast buttons of his uniform. That cut of the button on the palm of her hand was principally what she was to carry away. This was so near the end of a leaf from France that she could only wish him already gone. It was August 1916. Being not kissed, being drawn away from and looked at intimidated Kathleen, till she imagined spectral glitters in the place of his eyes. Turning away and looking back up the lawn, she saw, through branches of trees, the drawing-room window alight. She caught a breath for the moment when she should go running back into the safe arms of her mother and sister and cry, "What shall I do? What shall I do? He has gone." Hearing her catch her breath, her fiancé said without feeling, "Cold? You're going away such a long way." "Not so far as you think." "I don't understand." "You don't have to," he said. "You will. You know what we said. But that was... suppose... "I shall be with you," he said. "Sooner or later. You won't forget that. You need do nothing but wait." Only a little more than a minute later, she was free to run up the silent lawn. Looking in through the window at her mother and sister, who did not for the moment perceive her, she already felt that unnatural promise drive down between her and the rest of all humankind. No other way of having given herself could have made her feel so apart, lost, and forsworn. She could not have plighted a more sinister troth. Kathleen behaved well when, some months later, her fiancé was reported missing, presumably killed. Her family not only supported her but were able to praise her courage without stint because they could not regret, as a husband for her, the man they knew nothing about. They hoped she would, in a year or two, console herself. And had it been only a question of consolation, things might have gone much straighter ahead. But her trouble, beyond just a little grief, was a complete dislocation from everything. She did not reject other lovers, for these failed to appear. For years she failed to attract men, and with the approach of her 30s she became natural enough to share her family's anxiousness on this score. She began to put herself out, to wonder, and at 32 she was very greatly relieved to find herself being courted by William Jover. She married him, and the two of them settled down in this quiet, arboreal part of Kensington. In this house the years piled up. Her children were born, and they all lived till they were driven out by the bombs of the next war. Her movements, as Mrs. Jover, were circumscribed, and she dismissed any idea they were still watched. As things were, dead or living, the letter writer sent her only a threat. Unable for some minutes to go on kneeling, with her back exposed to the empty room, Mrs. Jover rose from the chest to sit on an upright chair whose back was firmly against the wall. The destitute of her former bedroom, her married London home's whole air of being a cracked cup from which memory, with its reassuring power, had either evaporated or leaked away, made a crisis. And just this crisis the letter writer had knowledgeably struck. The hollowness of the house this evening cancelled years on years of voices, habits, and steps. Through the shut windows she only heard rainfall and the roof sound. To rally herself, she said she was in a mood, and for 2 or 3 seconds, shutting her eyes, told herself that she had imagined the letter. But she opened them. There it lay on the bed. On the supernatural side of the letter's entrance she was not permitting her mind to dwell. Who in London knew she meant to call at the house today? Evidently, however, this had to be known. The caretaker, had he come back, had had no cause to expect her. He would have taken the letter in his pocket to forward it, in his own time, through the post. There was no other sign that the caretaker had been in, but if not, letters dropped in at doors of deserted houses do not fly or walk to tables and halls. They do not sit on the dust of empty tables with the air of certainty that they will be found. There is needed some human hand, but nobody but the caretaker had a key. Under the circumstances she did not care to consider, a house can be entered without a key. It was possible that she was not alone now. She might be being waited for downstairs. Waited for? Until when? Until the hour arranged. At least that was not 6 o'clock. 6 had struck. She rose from the chair and went over and locked the door. The thing was to get out. To fly? No, not that. She had to catch her train. As a woman whose utter dependability was the keystone of her family life, she was not willing to return to the country, to her husband, her little boys, and her sister without the objects she had come up to fetch. Resuming work at the chest, she set about making up a number of parcels in a rapid, fumbling, decisive way. These were her shopping parcels. Would be too much to carry. These meant a taxi. At the thought of the taxi, her heart went up and her normal breathing resumed. I will ring up the taxi now. The taxi cannot come too soon. I shall hear the taxi out there running its engine till I walk calmly down to it through the hall. I'll ring up. But no, the telephone is cut off. She tugged at a knot she had tied wrong. The idea of flight. He was never kind to me, not really. I don't remember him kind at all. Mother said he never considered me. He was set on me. That was what it was. Not love, not love. Not meaning a person well. What did he do to make me promise like that? I can't remember, but she found that she could. She remembered with such dreadful acuteness that the 25 years since then dissolved like smoke, and she instinctively looked for the wheel left by the button on the palm of her hand. She remembered not only all that he said and did, but the complete suspension of her existence during that August week. I was not myself. They all told me so at the time. She remembered, but with one white, burning blank, as where acid had dropped on a photograph. Under no conditions could she remember his face. So, wherever he may be waiting, I shall not know him. You have no time to run from a face you do not expect. The thing was to get to the taxi before any clock struck what could be the hour. It would slip down the street and around the side of the square to where the square gave on the main road. She would return in the taxi safe to her own door and bring the solid driver into the house with her to pick up the parcels from room to room. The idea of the taxi driver made her decisive, bold. She unlocked her door, went to the top of the staircase, and listened down. She heard nothing, but while she was hearing nothing, the passé air of the staircase was disturbed by a draft that traveled up to her face. It emanated from the basement. Down there, a door window was being opened by someone who chose this moment to leave the house. The rain had stopped, the pavement steamily shone, as Mrs. Drover let herself out by inches from her own front door onto the empty street. The unoccupied houses opposite continued to meet her look with their damaged stare. Making towards the thoroughfare and the taxi, she tried not to keep looking behind. Indeed, the silence was so intense. One of these creaks of London's silence exaggerated this summer by the damage of war, that no tread could have gained on hers unheard. When her street debouched on the square where people went on living, she grew conscious of and checked her unnatural pace. Across the opened end of the square, two buses impassively passed each other. Women, a perambulator cyclist, a man wheeling a barrow signaled, once again the ordinary flow of life. At the square most populous corner should be, and was, the short taxi rank. This evening only one taxi. But this, although it presented its blank rump, appeared already to be alertly waiting for her. Indeed, without looking round, the drive started the engine as she panted up from behind and put her hand on the door. As she did so, the clock struck 7. The taxi faced the main road. To make the trip back to her house, it would have to turn. She had settled back on the seat, and the taxi had turned before she, surprised by its knowing movement, recollected that she had not said where. She leaned forward to tap on the glass panel that divided the driver's head from her own. The driver, braked to what was almost a stop, turned around and slid the glass panel back. The jolt of this flung Mrs. Drover forward till her face was almost into the glass. Through the aperture, driver and passenger, not 6 inches between them, remained for an eternity eye to eye. Mrs. Drover's mouth hung open for some seconds before she could issue her first scream. After that, she continued to scream freely, and to beat with her gloved hand on the glass all around at the taxi, accelerating without mercy, made off with her into the hinterland of deserted streets.